So with that introduction, I now hand over to Brother Kevin to deliver his address on investigating Satan.
Okay, thank you very much, Martin, and a very good morning, everyone. The only place we're going to go to in our Bibles this morning is to that chapter we've had read, Job chapter 1. So we won't be flicking backwards and forwards, although this is obviously a very large subject and just doesn't involve the idea or the concept of Satan. There's the associated context of context of the devil and then demons and various other things. So really, we're just sort of dipping our toes into this subject this morning. There's a lot more that needs to be said about it. And we're going to look at it by way of reference to a film and also to a comedian, which sounds quite bizarre, doesn't it, really, when we're looking at the Word of God? But hopefully you'll see the reason for that as we get towards our consideration of what we've read in Job chapter 1. But before we do that, I think one or two thoughts and ideas that can give us a backdrop to this actual subject. The Christadelphian community, which is just one religious Christian community amongst thousands throughout the world, you've only got to Google to find out how many different sort of Christian denominations and sects there are, to the best of my knowledge, are the only community, or one in very, very, very few in number, who actually look at this subject of Satan in the way that we do. In other words, that the overwhelming majority of all the different churches and denominations, the largest church in the world, the Roman Catholic, to just sort of single sort of churches who stand on their own, all have an idea of this subject, which basically goes like this. At the beginning of time, the angels were with God, and some angels rebelled against God, and they were led by one called Lucifer, only appears once in the whole of the Bible, in the prophecy of Isaiah, or sometimes called the anointed cherub in Ezekiel chapter 28. And this angel rebelled against God and led away lots of other angels who became the demons, and they are now in opposition to God. So you've got God there, and you've got Satan, the devil, over there, and they are sworn enemies fighting each other over the hearts and the minds of ordinary men and women. God obviously wanting men and women to believe in him and follow him and do what he says according to what is revealed to us in the Bible. And Satan, the devil, wanting men and women not to believe in God and, if possible, to believe in him. That's where we have the occult and Satanists. So that, very simply put, is the existence of God and Satan. They are sworn enemies. Now, God is obviously exceedingly powerful, and so we need to ask the question, well, how powerful is this rebellious angel, Satan? And when I'm talking to people on this subject, I try to engage them before we look at the Bible and sort of get from them their perspective of who this Satan is, rebellious angel. Well, how powerful is he? What can he do? Has he got extraordinary powers, supernatural powers, miraculous powers? And you get them to start to tell you what they actually think about it. And not just with this subject, but with many others, it's quite instructive, because a lot of the time they haven't thought about these things. They just know, oh, there's God and there's Satan. We've got to be very wary of him. He's out to get us, as it were. And when you start to probe them, they suddenly realize they're not too sure exactly what they do believe in terms of power and authority and so on, about this supernatural being. So just going back to my first thought, if as a community, Christadelphians, who are not a large community, have this completely different idea and perspective on this subject, either we are hopelessly wrong, completely and utterly way off beam, we might say, or we've actually discovered something that so many people around us seemingly have not discovered. And the question is, well, how's that come about? Why is it that Christadelphians are so different in looking at what the Bible says about this subject? What's the reasoning for that? And that's, we're going to come on to that a little bit later, when we look at the first chapter of Job. Because when all said and done, generally speaking, again, all these churches around us, well, they say, yes, this is God's word, and it tells us all about him. And if they read it and we read it, we've come to a completely different understanding. How can that happen? This is the sort of question, one Bible, many churches. Why is that? What's the reason for that? As I say, we'll come to that in a moment. So just sort of one or two, as it were, or a few bullet points, so we can get straight into looking at the book of Job when we look at this subject. Now, I've used the phrase twice, I think, so far, Satan, the devil. That's actually the title. His name is Satan, supposedly, and he is the devil, like I was Kevin, the electrician. Kevin tells you who I am. The electrician tells you what I did. Well, Satan is supposedly his name, although there are other names as well, Beelzebub, and we could go through quite a few of them, like Lucifer. And his occupation, if you like, is being the devil. So sometimes he's referred to as the devil, the arch enemy of God. So we just stand back for a moment and think about our Bibles. Very big book, divided into two. The Old Testament, as it's called, and the New Testament. And the Old Testament is much bigger than the New Testament, both in terms of volume of pages and the number of books. And in the Old Testament, God, or the Lord, with the capital L-O-R-D, which is actually his name, and we're not going to go anywhere into sort of delving into that, you will find that written in the Bible nearly 7,000 times. Well, that's to be expected, isn't it? And that's just Lord, not just God as well. God adds on top of that. So if that's the case, and God is dealing in the Old Testament, we're not going to touch the New Testament because we haven't got the time to do that. If God is dealing with men and women in the Old Testament, and specifically for the overwhelming majority of the Old Testament, with his chosen people, the Jewish nation, he'll obviously tell them all about himself. And you would expect him, wouldn't you, to warn them about who is their enemy. And yet, when we look at the Bible, the Old Testament part, which is covering 4,000 years of God's dealing with his chosen people to whom he's revealed himself in all sorts of different ways, down to the minutiae of how they should live their lives and so on and so forth, you would expect them to spend a little bit of time warning them about this enemy they've got to be wary of. And yet, in the whole of the Old Testament, you will never ever find the word devil. And that's not our subject, but it's interesting to note this. Nowhere in the whole of 4,000 years of God talking to his people does he warn them about the devil, because it doesn't exist. It's a New Testament word. Only surfaces in the New Testament times. Now, why is that? Why hasn't God warned them about this devil? Well, he hasn't used the word devil, Kevin, but he's used the word Satan, yes. And if I was to ask you to guess how many times the word Satan is there in the Old Testament, anybody like to throw out a figure of how many times? Very quickly. Silence reigns, right? 18 times. You will only find the word Satan written as such in the King James Authorized Bible 18 times. If you've got a more modern translation, you will lose one of those words written as Satan. It's in the book of Psalms 109, you'll find that the word Satan actually occurs four times there, three of them in my King James Authorized 1611 version. It has been translated by an English word, but Satan was left there once. But more modern translations have now actually got rid of that Satan and put an English word in, the resister, because that's all the word means. It's not a name as such. It's a word which has been left in the Hebrew idiom, if you like, and been given a capital S to make the name as if it is this archenemy of God, when in fact it's just an ordinary Hebrew word, which means the resister, the adversary. And in those 17 times that are left, all of them, bar four, appear in the chapter we've read, well, this and the second chapter. So when you start to think about it from that perspective, there's God with his archenemy. We've got a very large book divided into two. My Old Testament goes, and I'm going to get towards the end of it, well over 1,000 pages, perhaps 1,200. Let's have a quick look. Yes, I'm nearly in 1,200. And in 1,200 pages, you only find the reference to God's supposed arch enemy 18 times or 17 times. And the majority of those are in one book of that Bible, and not just in that one book, but in the first two chapters of that one book. And that's basically it. The other place we find the word Satan is in 1 Chronicles 21 and in the prophecy of Zechariah chapter 3. And once you've looked at those, you've exhausted the subject. You've then got to go on to the New Testament. So with that as a sort of background, let's open our Bibles, if we haven't already got them open, to the book of Job and this first chapter. And as the title implies, investigate Satan. As I've said, there's so much we could say. The word is just an ordinary Hebrew word, satan, which means an adversary or an opponent. If we wanted to find the first place it is actually in our Old Testament, we'd have to go to the book of Numbers in chapter 22, where we won't read it as Satan as such. We will read it as withstand in one verse. And it's actually applicable to an angel of God who is obedient to God, whom God sends to stand in the way to prevent a false prophet called Balaam going to curse his people Israel. Now, obviously, if they put Satan there, it would make any sense at all. God sends Satan to withstand this prophet. Well, that's nonsense, because they're arch enemies. You know, why is God so? And when you start to think about it, that the whole thing doesn't sort of seem to fit together. That's where, in a moment, the idea that the comedian will come in. So we're going to look at the book of Job, chapter 1. So then, before we actually think about this comedian, let's think about the film I mentioned. It's a film which I think is the best film that's ever been made, and it involves 12 men. It's called 12 Angry Men. I think some here have probably seen the film 12 Angry Men. If you haven't seen it, or you have seen it, go and look at it again with what we're thinking about this morning in mind. It was made in the 50s and stars Henry Fonda, who was obviously a well-known actor. And very, very briefly, and I haven't got as much time I would like to go into this, it is about a courtroom scene. But all you ever see, apart from the first perhaps minute and the last minute of the whole film, about an hour and a half long, are these 12 men in one room. Now, in one sense, you can't get any more boring than that, can you? 12 men in one room, you know, sort of chatting away. But the opening scene is a young Hispanic American boy, probably 14, 15, who's been accused of murdering his father. And you see this frightened boy in the dock, this 14, 15 year old, and these 12 men who've listened to exactly the same information, haven't they? They've been sat there for however long the trial took place, listening to the defense lawyer and the prosecution lawyer give exactly the same information. They've all heard exactly the same, just like Christadelphians, Catholics, Baptists, more, the whole lot have all looked at the Bible, the same information book. But we've come to a completely different understanding from most churches around us. And so these 12 men have heard all the same information, given in exactly the same way as well, haven't they? So the facial expressions, the raising of the voices, the lowering of the voices, the intonation of the voice when it's being spoken, which is something we haven't got when we read the Bible. We have to think, well, how is that actually being said? With what attitude of mind is it being said? And I'll give you a quick example. If I say, Martin Bullivant is a wonderful chap, you know what I've said. But if I say, Martin Bullivant's a wonderful chap, exactly the same word, but by the way I've said it and my facial expression gives completely the opposite perspective, isn't it, about him? Well, these 12 men have actually seen all that take place. They've heard all the arguments, and they've been sent away to deliberate as to whether this Hispanic boy is guilty or not. And as you have known, if you've seen the film, there's a man put in charge, the foreman of the jurors, and they all sit round. It's a very, very hot day. Not air conditioning, but the fan's broken. There's a thunderstorm brewing, and they sit down. And the foreman says, right, I suppose the first thing we ought to do is have a vote to see what we think about it. So they go all around, you know, it's guilty, 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 not guilty. And it's 11 guilty, one not guilty. And straight away, you know, who's said not guilty? You know, why have you said not guilty? What's going on here? You've heard exactly the same information to us. Why are you standing out alone against us 11? A bit like Christadelphia standing out against everybody else. Why? And Henry Fonda obviously is the star of the film. He's the one who does that. And he says, right, well, let's just spend a bit of time examining, you know, what we've heard. Let's just investigate it a bit, shall we? Not just jump to an immediate conclusion as to, well, it's obvious he's guilty. Let's just sort of investigate all the evidence that's been brought forth. And that's what they do throughout the film, for those who haven't seen it. And gradually, as the film develops, every so often they have another vote, and 11 guilty, one not guilty becomes 10 guilty and two not guilty. And the second one who says not guilty is a very elderly gentleman. Well, there's no point in listening to him because he's old. He doesn't understand what's going on, to be honest. And what actually comes out of the film, that's why I think it's just a wonderful film, is the actual prejudices and the preconceived ideas that these 12 men have about that one little boy, well, a little 14, 15-year-old. And I could go now through all the 12 different jurors and bring out their prejudices, but time will not allow for it. But there's one man there, he's the second last to be convinced. He will only be convinced by logic and reason. And eventually he comes to the conclusion in looking at all the evidence that the man is not guilty, that the boy is not guilty. The very last man, a big powerful actor, Lee J. Cobb, he is convinced eventually. And the reason he thinks the boy is guilty is because he's got a son, the same age as him, but his son has no interest whatsoever in taking over the business that this man has built up. He's got no interest whatsoever. This man, this father, has spent all his time, you know, 15 hours a day, 7 days a week for years, building up this business so his son can sort of take it over. And his son's not interested. And he's so angry with his own son, he transfers that anger onto this young Hispanic American boy he's never met before. That's his prejudice. And so it goes on throughout the film. Please, if you get the opportunity, have a look at it. And so eventually, after the film comes to the end, and you can guess what happens, it goes one not guilty, 11 guilty, two not guilty, 10 guilty, four not guilty, eight. And it all starts to reverse until you get 11 not guilty and one guilty. And as I've just explained, the man at the end breaks down in tears and they all go out and say not guilty. Now, we never know who actually killed the boy's father. It doesn't tell us that. All it does by looking at the information is come to the conclusion that it wasn't the boy himself. So that's the first part. The comedian, it's a man called Les Dawson. Many of you have heard of Les Dawson. Famous in his day for two things, really. One, mother-in-law jokes, which would be completely unacceptable today. And the second one was being able to play the piano badly. Now, if you don't know, again, Les Dawson, you'd have to watch him, but he was an absolutely superb pianist. He wrote music as well. He could play beautifully. And yet every so often, you start to play a tune and he'd put in what we would call a dud note or a bum note, right? And everybody would fall about laughing. Now, apparently that's very, very difficult for someone who knows exactly how to play the right note. Now, I've deliberately got to say, I must not play that note. I must play the next one above or below it. Now, I, as most of you know, I've got no idea what to do with music. You know, I've got no idea, you know, my wife will tell you I can't sing. I've got no idea what crotch, I know what the names are, but I've got no idea what they do. So I can listen to a piece of music though, and I can say, that's a wrong note. I don't know why it's a wrong note. I don't know what the right note is. But you can tell when you listen, it doesn't sound right. I don't know what the right note is, but there's got to be one somewhere. So with those two thoughts in mind, let's go to the book of Job and look at this subject with all the other things that I've said. It starts off, and it is reckoned that the book of Job is one of the earliest books of the Bible, even though it comes sort of halfway through our Old Testament. It's actually one of the very early books of the Bible. And so we are told in verse 1, there's a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. That man was perfect or blameless. He was upright, a man of integrity, one that feared God. He reverenced God and eschewed evil, wanted nothing to do with evil. So we've got this description of this man. That's a wonderful description, isn't it? He's blameless. He does everything right, as it were. He's a man of integrity, of honesty. And that's what we hear nowadays in what's happening, with the leadership or the proposed leadership of the Tory party. It's all been caused by sleaze and dishonesty and all the rest of it. Well, this man is the complete opposite. He believes in God, he fears God, he reverences God, and he wants nothing to do anything which is evil. If I'm talking to someone on this subject, I will say to them, and let's say for the sake of argument, I'm talking to someone who belongs to the largest of the evangelical churches, the Baptist Church. Because whilst this subject that we are thinking about does not figure at all prominently in a lot of the more sort of liberal churches, as it were, people like the Jehovah's Witnesses and particularly the conservative evangelicals, who are very vociferous, wholeheartedly believe in a rebellious angel who's the archenemy of God, etc. It is a fundamental belief for them, and it needs to be thought about. So I sort of say to the person I'm talking to, if for example, he's a Baptist, I say, well, here's a picture of the minister at your church, isn't it? If he's just like the minister at your church. And if he says, well, what do you mean? Well, would you say the minister at your church, he's not blameless, we all do things wrong, but he's a very, very moral person. He's got standards. He's full of integrity. He absolutely believes in God and doesn't want anything to do with evil. Would that describe the minister of your church, or perhaps even some of the congregation? And if he says, no, they're not like that, I say, well, what sort of people have you got at your church then? Do they believe in God or don't they believe in God? Do they try to live godly lives or don't? And they've got to say, well, yes, this is generally a good description of someone in our church. Might even be the person I'm talking to. Okay. They were born unto him 7 sons, 3 daughters. And we read, as we read through Martin, he was an exceptionally wealthy man, wasn't he? 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500. So, what I do is I sort of bring this to the modern day. So I say, well, if he's a member of your congregation, someone you perhaps look up to because he's a very moral person, he's got a thriving accountancy business, shall we say. The headquarters is in Coventry, but he's got 4 or 5 branches dotted throughout the Midlands. He's got a holiday home in the south of France. He's got a yacht down in Poole Harbour. He's got everything. Wants for nothing at all. And we get an insight into his character in verse 4. His sons went out and feasted in their houses every one his day and sent and called for their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. It seems that they were part of the family business but could have holidays right, left and centre. And it was so, verse 5, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them. He rose up early in the morning, offered sacrifices on their behalf. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus did Job continually. He was very much a family man, looking after not only the material welfare or well-being of his children, but also their spiritual well-being. That's how God-fearing and upright and blameless this man was. You almost couldn't wish for a better father in a godly home, could you? Now, verse 6, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them. There you are, Kevin, there's Satan. It says so, and you're right. But if you've got the same sort of Bible as me, you may have a little number next to it, Satan. You go to the margin, it says Hebrew, the adversary. So they could have put down there. Now, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and the adversary came also amongst them. And we asked the question, well, who was the adversary? And we don't know. But because the translators have put Satan in, because they've got this preconceived idea of a rebellious angel against God, well, this fits the bill. So we'll put it in there as Satan. No warrant for that whatsoever. But that's what it says. Sons of God, well, that's the angels, isn't it? Again, does it say it was the angels? It could be, it may not be. But all we're doing is looking and investigating and asking questions. And they came to present themselves before the Lord. That's the capital L-O-R-D that I mentioned to you at the beginning. Nearly 7,000 times, as opposed to Satan only being 17 times. So this is the angels coming to God in heaven, and Satan comes with them. That's an understanding we could attach to those verses. But it may be other things. We could go off now and look at sons of God elsewhere and say it's ordinary people. We could look about people who presented themselves before the Lord, and they were on the earth. But I don't want to go here, there, and everywhere. I want us to stick to what we're reading. So that's a definite understanding that we could attach to this. The angels come to present themselves in God's presence, and Satan came also among them. But let's just pause for a moment and start to investigate. We've already said, and we've got our friend to imagine, there's God, there's Satan. They are at war with one another. They're arch enemies. And normally, if I've talked about this, I start to go back to the Second World War. But let's bring it right up to date, shall we? Let's talk about what's happening today. You've got Zelensky, the president of the Ukraine, with all the people around him and all those in Europe who are supporting him. And you've got Putin with his one or two supporters. They're at war with one another. And we know what's going on. Now, can you imagine Putin one day suddenly deciding he's going to get into an Aeroflot flight and go from Moscow to Kyiv and land there, get a train or a taxi to wherever Zelensky is hiding, as it were, because obviously he doesn't want to be found, and walking into his bunker or whatever and beginning a conversation with him? It's just nonsense, isn't it? But that's what we're being asked to believe here with the conventional understanding of God or the Lord and Satan. This Satan just wanders in, it seems, into the presence of God, and a conversation takes place. This is what I call my Les Dawson moment. It's a dud note. It doesn't ring true, does it? It doesn't ring true at all. That would never happen. The moment that Putin set foot on Ukrainian soil, he would be arrested. He may have even got to go and see Zelensky, probably somebody would shoot him. But here's Satan just wandering into the court of heaven, so we're glad to believe. Verse 7, and the Lord said unto Satan, whence comest thou? And Satan says, well, from going to and fro in the earth and walking up and down upon it. And so God starts a conversation. Where have you been? What have you been doing? And the Satan replies. And then the Lord said unto Satan, have you looked at my servant Job? There's none like him in the earth. He's a perfect and upright man. He fears me and eschews evil. So that description back in verse 1 is ratified by God himself. It's not somebody else's opinion, or it may well be. This is God's opinion of this man. Now, again, just pause for a moment. Would God draw to the attention of his arch enemy one of his most faithful followers? Of course he wouldn't. He would want to shield him from his arch enemy as much as he could. Again, it's like Zelensky saying to Putin in this conversation they're having, have you looked at my general Azimov, the one who's in charge in Donbass and all the problems? He's brilliant. It wouldn't happen, would it? Zelensky wouldn't breathe a word to Putin about whose his generals are and what they're doing. It just doesn't ring true. And so verse 9, Satan answered the Lord and says, well, does Job fear you for nothing? Haven't you made a hedge about him, about his house, about all that he hath on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his substance increased in the land. Well, it's no wonder he believes in you. You've given him everything. We've seen the description. Thriving accountancy business, holiday home in the south of France, yacht in Poole Harbour, and so on. That's why he believes in you, God. And there are those, especially in some of the mega churches in America, who believe this is what God's all about. If you've got wealth, it's because he's blessed you like that, because you've done everything right. If you're poor, well, there's something going wrong somewhere. It's called the wealth gospel, particularly in America. And then verse 11, Satan says, well, you put forth your hand now and touch all he has, and he'll curse you to your face. And again, I pause for a moment and think, well, hang on a minute. There's God, powerful, all-powerful, and we've already established that Satan has got some miraculous power, supernatural power. Why is he saying to God, God, if you do this to this faithful follower of yours, then he'll curse you to your face? That's your job, Satan. You go and do it. Why are you asking me to do it? And the more we start to ask questions and think about it, the more we can see, hopefully, that the conventional understanding just does not fit the evidence that's being presented. On a face value, quick reading, yes. But let's go into the courtroom and just spend a few hours thinking about it, shall we? And asking questions. You know, what actually happened there? Could that person have actually seen this young boy do it? And so on, rather than just simply say, well, he looks guilty, he is guilty, that's it, let's go. So verse 12, the Lord says unto Satan, well, all he has is in your power, only upon himself put not forth thine hand. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. So God says, okay, I'll give way to you, my arch enemy. You go and do all these terrible things to that which he's got, but don't touch him. That's not a war, is it? That's again like Zelensky saying to Putin, well, look, Putin, you can do this, that, and the other in the Donbass region, but you can't do that and that. It's just nonsense, isn't it? You don't fight wars like that. This Satan, whoever it is, this adversary, seemingly has no power of his own whatsoever. He has to rely on God. And so verse 13, there was a day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking, and all sorts of calamitous things happen. We've read it. Bring up to our day, you know, the inspectors come in, look at the accountancy firm, there's all sorts of things going wrong, and they close the whole lot down. There's a tsunami down in Pearl Harbor, as it seems, and the yacht sinks. Vandals over in south of France invade his holiday home and take it over. He loses absolutely everything. Verse 19. Behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness, smote the four corners of the house. It fell upon the young men, and they are dead. And I only am escaped alone to tell thee. And to top it all, his family, his children are all killed through an accident. An act of God, some would say, nowadays. A great wind and destroys the house. Now look at the response of this man. Then Job arose, rent his mantle, his robe, shaved his head. And you can imagine, can't you? He's absolutely distraught. He's beside himself. He doesn't know where to turn. Everything was going so wonderfully well, and everything's gone horrendously wrong for this man and his family, apart from him and his wife. So he tears his clothes off him, he shaves his head, he falls down upon the ground and worships and said, naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. And we have that phrase, we bring nothing into the world, we can't take anything out. We come in naked, no matter what we accrue in this life, when we die, wherever we die, we can't take it with us. We can't take our cars, our homes, and all the rest of it, our pension pots, whatever. But look how he ends it, verse 21. The Lord gave and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Now that can't be right, can it? That just cannot be right. That's completely and utterly wrong. There must be something wrong with that translation. Because here's this man who fears God. He's the perfect Christian. And you go to any of the churches around us and say to that perfect Christian, God's blessed you with all the good things. Who's the one responsible for all the terrible things that's going to happen to you, possibly? Oh, it's Satan, isn't it? He's the arch enemy. We've got to be wary of him. So those who blame Satan are the ones who believe in God. Those who blame God are the ones who do not believe in God, because that's their get-out clause, isn't it? If there is a God, why does he allow all this? Why is he allowing what's going on in Ukraine? Why is he allowing, and we could go on and on, multiply. If there is a God, why does he do all this or allow all this? That's the atheist point of view. But this man is not an atheist. He's a God-fearing man. He eschews evil. He's a man of integrity. And he says, this is what God has done. That has got to be wrong from the generally accepted view of Satan. And the only explanation I've ever been given on this subject when I've talked to people about it is, well, Job didn't know about the existence of Satan, didn't know he was there. And I go, well, I'm glad I'm the same position as Job, because I don't think there's a Satan there. There isn't a Satan. It doesn't exist. I'm just like Job then. Job should be blaming Satan, but he doesn't. And the chapter could end there, but it doesn't. It goes on in verse 22. In all this, Job sinned not, didn't say anything which was sinful, and he didn't charge God foolishly. He did not attribute to God things which were not true. So this God-fearing Christian man, this pillar of your church, Mr. Baptist, he says, God has given me all this. God has taken it away. There is no room, there is no hint in this man's theology, if you like, about this Satan, the devil. And that's exactly where we as Christadelphians stand. We could go to chapter 2, and we won't, because of time. Just one final thought. Does it really matter, Kevin? You know, you've gone through that quite quickly. There's a lot more that could be said. It could be developed. But at the end of the day, does it really matter, you know, whether you believe there was an angel who rebelled or not? That's irrelevant. Lots of other things are irrelevant. All you've got to do is believe in God and that Jesus has died for your sins. That's the cry from so many around us now. That's all that matters. Everything else doesn't really matter. Well, the first question is, if that's the case, why is it here? You know, why have we got all this information about this if it's not to understand? And secondly, the other way I look at it, I look at it this way. Now, I don't know whether Mark at the back there supports any football team. Do you follow any football team? Right, he's a Coventry City supporter, right? Naturally, right? Now, if I go around and speak to somebody and say, oh, we're having a chat with Mark Forbes the other day. Oh, yeah, I remember Mark. Oh, yeah. Oh, he's a Leicester City supporter, you know. Is he? Oh, yeah, he follows them everywhere. He's got the kit, he's got the works. And I went around saying that, and word got back to Mark, and I've been telling everybody he's a Leicester City supporter. What do you think he'd say? Would he say, Leicester City, Coventry City, Crewe Alexander, who cares, it's all football, doesn't matter. You know, let Kevin say what he wants about me. Of course not. None of us would want that to happen, would we? We want people to tell, as far as they can, the truth about us, or the truth about something we hold dear. Why then do you think God, having given us all this information, do you think he'd ever say, well, it doesn't really matter whether you believe in Satan has been an angel or not. You know, it's irrelevant. It doesn't really matter whether you believe you're going to go to heaven or on the... It's irrelevant. As long as you believe in me, that's all that matters. It makes no sense whatsoever. That's why it's important to understand these things. That's why it's important to investigate these things, not just this subject, but all other Bible topics. Only then can we come to a proper understanding of what God wants us to know about this, and it will shape our attitude to lots of other things in the Bible. Because I haven't mentioned, have I, the nature and the evilness of man. This is where it would lead to. But that's another subject.